This is going to sound really boring, but remember, we are talking 17% of the American economy, gang.
Motion to proceed to calendar number 120, H.R. 1628, an act to provide for reconciliation pursuant to Title II of the concurrent resolution on the budget for fiscal year 2017.
Told you boring, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. Tuesday, the 25th day of July. Good as always to have you here, everybody. We started with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer yesterday on the Democrats' plans for 2018 and 2020. Turnabout being fair play. Here is Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor this afternoon.
Many of us on this side of the aisle have waited for years for this opportunity and thought it would probably never come.
Senate Republicans and a whole lot of other people, too, probably, which gets us to this. Now that the Senate has agreed to debate health care, again, a sixth of the American economy, more than $3 trillion in GDP, what comes next?
I don't know exactly what the first thing they're going to do. I don't think they know.
David Hopkins is an associate professor of political science at Boston University. To review here, and as you heard the clerk of the Senate say up at the top, this bill is being debated under what is called reconciliation, which brings with it some legislative complications.
The main restrictions are that anything that's in the reconciliation bill has to affect, all the provisions have to affect either revenue or expenditures. So a lot of the, for example, insurance company regulations that were in the original Affordable Care Act, because they don't actually affect the federal government's expenditures or revenues, they would not be allowed in a reconciliation bill, or repeal of them would not be allowed.
We've got 20 legislative hours, Hopkins points out, which will run the rest of today, most of tomorrow, Thursday maybe, and then...
At some point, we will either see an agreement come together on a particular bill that will have the 51 votes necessary, or the time will just run out and that agreement will never come to fruition.
And then, well, we just don't know, do we? Lost in the shuffle of healthcare and personnel machinations at the White House today, honestly, I'd forgotten this myself, is that the Fed is meeting today and tomorrow. They're not going to raise interest rates, probably, but chances are they will again before the end of the year. And since the Fed started raising, the benchmark federal funds rate has gone up a full percentage point. When it goes up, so too do other rates consumers have to pay, mortgages, credit cards, the whole deal. And yet, the rates that banks pay us for our deposits, nada. With one big exception, Marketplace's Bree Beneschel reports.
In the past year and a half, the Fed has raised rates four times. And four times, the interest rate on your bank account probably hasn't budged a bit.
Right now, the average savings account rate remains mired at 0.08%.
Greg McBride is with Bankrate.com. That means on a savings account of $1,000, you'd earn a whopping 80 cents a year. Banks, for a while now, haven't had to dangle higher interest rates in front of customers because customers haven't been very demanding.
In the aftermath of the financial crisis, consumers were very risk-averse. A lot of people were piling money into banks.
So banks are sitting on stacks of cash. But there are pockets where deposit rates are rising. Jeffrey Elliott is a partner at Autonomous Research.
One area is large corporate deposits.
Companies with a lot of money have been giving banks a hard time about low interest rates.
So for a large corporate with millions of dollars of deposit balances, then earning a fraction of a percent more on that deposit is worth pushing for.
And when a company with millions in the bank threatens to go elsewhere, banks listen. But when will the rest of us see better rates? Paul Gentile is president of the Cooperative Credit Union Association.
And I think it's going to take until the first, second quarter of next year to see marketable changes in rates.
There are, just so you know, a few banks and credit unions out there offering higher rates now, but you got to dig for them. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Okay, now shoes. Seriously. Shoes. Jimmy Choo has been among the biggest names in high-end footwear for decades now, but the company put itself up for sale in April. Today, a buyer, Michael Kors, $1.2 billion. Kors has been struggling, and it's looking for a little boost. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
After years of expanding its mass market stores, Michael Kors announced in May it would close 125 of them. The brand had been suffering from traffic declines, big revenue drops, and a hit to its upscale cachet as it moved into more outlet malls. William Blair analyst Dylan Carden says the company's move into high-end footwear comes as the affordable luxury handbag market is in trouble.
That category, which has been on a tear over the past sort of 10 years to 2014, has now materially slowed and could even go negative here. So if that's your bread and butter at over 70% of sales, you've kind of got to look to other areas to drive growth.
Jane Halley runs a retail investment research firm. With Jimmy Choo in its portfolio, she says Kors will reach new customers and tap into growing markets for luxury goods abroad.
We're seeing that with the devaluation of the euro and the pound, that luxury business has increased. People are buying luxury again.
As pressure from e-commerce continues, analysts expect more bricks-and-mortar retail brands to team up for leverage, like when Coach bought competitor Kate Spade earlier this year. Pete Killian is with consulting firm The Cambridge Group.
Either formal, in this case, or loose alliances of brands are going to need to come together to sort of form that critical mass of customers.
Or to use a superhero analogy,
Superman is dead and the Avengers are in charge.
The CEO of Michael Kors said today that it's looking to form a so-called luxury group, and Jimmy Choo will not be its last acquisition. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Wait, Superman is dead? What? Wall Street today, relatively calm to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've remarked on this a little bit the past couple of weeks. In fact, I just did. How generally calm the markets have been. No really big swings either way to speak of. Nice for those who like a little stability in their capitalism. Less than great for those who make money trading on that volatility. We're talking commodity trading here specifically, where the lack of volatility and weak oil as well has hit bankers and investors. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at that.
Commodities indices may include all sorts of things like corn and copper, but they're heavily weighted towards energy, like crude oil. Rich Feltis is head of market insights for R.J. O'Brien and Associates.
The CRB, the Commodity Research Bureau, which is the basket of all commodities, the core part of that is the crude market. It's over 50% of the valuation and weighting.
And crude prices have been depressed, which turns investors off. So investors have gravitated more towards stocks and bonds, where there's more positive performance.
In commodities, the speculators, the bulls, love a rising market. They're not so enamored with falling markets.
Why are oil prices down? Producers, including members of OPEC, haven't cut production enough to push oil prices up. Here's University of Houston energy economist Ed Herz.
OPEC wants to enforce production cuts, but hasn't been doing a great job with it this year. The price of crude has stayed below $50 a barrel for the better part of 2017.
The other issue? There hasn't been much volatility in crude prices. No crazy ups and downs. Investors like volatility because they can profit from big price moves. Samir Samana is a strategist with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
The volatility thus far this year has been lower than it has been historically.
Until there's some better crude oil performance or more volatility, Samana says banks that are heavily reliant on commodity trading revenues will have a rough time, whereas banks geared more towards deposits and lending will probably fare better. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
You can take your gross domestic product and your unemployment report, and you can keep them. That's what you can do. The key to economic growth here and elsewhere has long been held to be productivity. How many widgets produced per hour worked? Well, I saw something in the New York Times today about that, and I got to say, it brought me up short. Neil Irwin wrote it. Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Don't mind telling you, I was a little dismayed to read the headline on this piece. Maybe we've been thinking about the productivity slump all wrong. Help. How should we be thinking about it?
Well, you know, the way that I and I think a lot of people who think a lot about economics have tended to think about productivity is this thing that magically happens. You know, innovators come up with ideas, businesses figure out new ways to do things, and in the process, they're able to save labor, and people are able to have higher incomes over time. And I think we tend to think of that as a totally separate thing from what happens in the kind of cyclical ups and downs of the economy, whether there's a recession or not. And the argument that I've heard from some really thoughtful people and that I'm really coming to grips with is the idea that maybe when the economy is in a recession, that's a thing that causes low productivity rather than something that is a result of it.
So give me an example of that, because honestly, the idea that maybe we've been thinking about this thing that we all thought had been key backwards is a little intimidating.
Well, the first clue is there's a little bit of a coincidence that happens. If you go back to 2007, 2008, 2009, productivity fell off a cliff then. Productivity mm-hmm. growth has been much lower since then than it was before. So why might that be? Well, it could just be a coincidence. You know, maybe inventors aren't coming up with good inventions. Maybe we're not getting the kinds of new ideas that could really drive forward innovation and growth. Then again, maybe employers don't have any reason to invest in innovation. Maybe there are ideas out there that could make American businesses more productive, and they're not spending the money to put in place those innovations because unemployment has been high, because wages have been low, because we haven't had the kind of growth that we might expect. And that's a really important and intriguing idea.
Is this necessarily a bad thing? I guess I read this piece and I was like, oh, man, this is terrible. But maybe it's not.
Yeah, I think it actually is an idea that has a lot of promise and suggests that we're not in this productivity slump without any hope of getting out. It might just be an artifact of this long, slow recovery we've had and the kind of depressed economy we've had for much of the last 10 years. So maybe as the labor market gets tighter, as the economy gets revving faster, maybe employers are going to find that they need to invest more in equipment and software and the kinds of things that can make their workers more productive. And if that happens, that's the pathway to higher incomes. You know, it's not just about how many jobs, and you know, we worry about people losing their jobs to robots. It's about, do people have jobs that pay a high income? And productivity growth is the pathway to get that. So this is actually, to me, very hopeful that maybe there is that pathway and we could have a brighter future.
There were, not that I was counting, but I was, there were two maybes and one if in that sentence. So spitball the future for me.
A lot of this is kind of speculative. It's kind of looking at the way the timing lines up. That said, talking to people from the business world, they really do say that capital spending has been low because of this, you know, weak economic environment. You know, maybe if you're a company and you're a CEO and you're trying to decide what to do, if the labor market's tighter, when unemployment's low, there aren't a lot of workers out there, maybe that's the moment you really invest in things that might make your company better off in the long run, U.S. economic growth higher in the long run, and incomes higher in the long run.
Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, writing today about productivity in this economy. Neil, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
One of the truisms of reporting on this economy is that whatever the good or even okay headline numbers are, they don't really matter much if people's individual experiences don't match. That's the idea behind our series, My Economy. Today's installment comes to us from Los Alamos, New Mexico.
My name is Jeff Reeves. I'm a space scientist at Los Alamos National Lab. There's activity on the sun that can create storms in space. I do research that understands how that energy propagates from the sun to the Earth, what it does to the space around the Earth, and what sort of effects that can have on satellites and things. To put it in really broad terms, the research that labs like Los Alamos do are anticipating the problems of the future before they become problems and trying to come up with potential solutions for those problems before we need them. The overall funding for government labs tends to be fairly reliable, fairly constant, at least up until now. I know a lot of people are still suffering personally very strongly from the economy as it is. And, you know, I don't want to sit here and say, well, everything is fine for us, and so to heck with the rest of the country. We live off of taxpayer dollars, and most of the people that I know are really grateful for that. There is more money going into research in general, but there is money being taken away from other equally important things. And it's kind of a scary time to be a researcher in a climate that is increasingly hostile to science and the truth.
That was Jeff Reeves. We got him in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Take a second. Tell us how you're getting by. Would you? There is a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
We're running on empty. The farm crisis is real.
The heartland economy straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 100 points today, 0.4%, closed at 21,613. The NASDAQ up a point. We'll call that flat, finished at 6412. You know why we call it flat? Because it is 1 point. S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.2%, 24.77 there. We walk down the runway on fashion company Michael Kors' plan to buy Jimmy Choo. Michael Kors essentially unchanged today. Jimmy Choo up 17%. CEO John Idol's statement that Kors plans to add more companies to its collection, gave the whole sector a bit more bling. Ralph Lauren pocketed 2.6%. Burberry dressed up 0.7%. Today, healthcare today, just cause. Cigna off 0.4%. Aetna gained about 0.1%. Humana slipped about 0.25% today. The price of metals, copper, silver, rising, putting a bit of a polish on mining companies. Colorado-based Newmont Mining up 6.9% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.33%. Remember, Fed, tomorrow, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Of all the statistics and figures one hears about in an economic sense, there are few more important to one's personal economy than the credit score. It can affect where you live, where you shop, sometimes where you can find a job. Josh Lauer is a professor of media studies at the University of New Hampshire. His new book, it's called Creditworthy, is about the very long history of what he calls the credit surveillance industry in this country, which, by the way, looks a whole lot different in this century than it did in the last one, or the one before that, for that matter. Josh, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Not to impugn anybody who works in the credit industry today, but it does kind of seem like consumers in this economy right now have been reduced to a set of numbers and algorithms that all you have to do is run a couple of computer programs and boom, you're done.
Before credit scores, if you wanted to open an account at a department store or get a personal loan at a bank, you had to go and meet personally with the credit manager. And he or she would take your application and have a conversation with you and try and gauge something about your integrity and whether you were the kind of person who would be trustworthy.
Nothing could possibly go wrong there.
Right? No, of course not. Yeah. But it's actually kind of complicated because on the one hand, credit scoring is supremely rational and you can have agreed upon variables that are non-discriminatory. But the other side of that is that when you could meet with another human being and say, hey, you know, I can see there's a blemish in my credit report or I was late on this payment, I can tell this individual, the credit manager, that it was because of a medical debt or I lost my job temporarily or I was laid off. And you can contextualize things that you cannot do when credit scores are used.
Which gets to a deeper point that you explicitly say in the book, credit is a matter of social trust. I guess here's my question about that. That certainly was true in the early days when everybody knew everybody. But does that still exist today where, again, we're just numbers and banks are spitting out forms and yes, you get the loan or no, you don't?
I would say it does still exist, and not for the reasons that we might think, but the way that we use credit information for employment, for example, some of the information that's being requested doesn't really have to do with whether or not you pay your debts. It's more about whether you are a more responsible person, whether you can be trusted. And yes, that's not social trust in the context of, you know, everyone getting along and in a communal sense, but a sense that you are a member of society and you're the kind of person that we want to work with or have, you know, associated with our business.
What would happen in the economy today if we just didn't have credit bureaus?
It's actually unimaginable. So think about something simple, like you go to a big box store and you're checking out and the employee at the register says, hey, would you like to save 10% today by opening a store charge account? Well, all you have to do is provide a driver's license and a social security number. And in a couple of minutes, you can walk out of that store with hundreds or thousands of dollars of merchandise all with the little promise that you might pay one day. And this is the
might pay. You know, that's a great line, right? Yeah,
that's the foundation of the modern credit economy, and for the most part, it works.
Josh Lauer, he is a professor of media studies at the University of New Hampshire. His new book is called Creditworthy. It's a history of credit and consumer surveillance in this economy. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
There was a forecast from the Department of Agriculture this spring that was bad news for the farm economy, grain farmers in particular who were trying to make ends meet. Ag says net farm income is expected to fall this year for the fourth straight year. It's a crisis, according to some. Peggy Lowe of Harvest Public Media checked in with some farmers out in the Midwest.
We're in Tom Giesel's work office today, his pickup, driving the back roads of central Kansas to look at where he just finished harvesting his wheat crop.
And here's some more of my fields. The field I farm up there on the hill made a little over 100 bushel an acre.
Giesel is a fourth-generation farmer who considers his commodities to be his currency. He had a good crop this year, and after the landlord takes a cut, Giesel made $240 an acre. Still,
net $240 will not buy one bag of seed corn, because a bag of seed corn could be upwards of $300 or more.
So here's Giesel's math using his commodity currency.
I used 500 acres of my total wheat crop just to buy that corn, let alone any fertilizer, herbicide, machinery, my time.
Giesel says he's struggling to cover his expenses and the farm is not making a profit.
We're running on empty. The farm crisis is real.
Prices for wheat, corn, and soybeans are low, and there's a global glut of grain. Fearing the worst, the National Farmers Union in May set up a farm crisis webpage with information about loans, mediation, disaster relief, and a suicide prevention hotline. Bill Watson is president of the agribusiness division of UMB Bank, a top 20 farm lender based in Kansas City.
Crisis is a very personal concept. Okay. What's a condition for someone else might be a crisis for me.
Watson remembers a worse time. In the 1980s, thousands of farmers lost their land, ag banks failed, and Main Street businesses went belly up. Watson says there are a couple of big differences between back then and today. Farmers carried a lot of debt in the 80s, and interest rates were very high, unlike the low rates today. Yet, Watson agrees that farm income is a problem. And after four consecutive years of losing money, it comes down to
whether you fail making a payment on your equipment, a payment on your land, a payment to your landlord. That's when things really start to change for you. And so I would submit to you that's the definition of a crisis.
I talked to David Widmar, an ag economist at Purdue University in Indiana, via Skype. He says that another big difference between today and the 80s is that back then, exports had dried up. Overseas sales today are steady, but some worry about trade in the future. The NAFTA renegotiation starts next month.
Our take is that we are in an adjustment period in agriculture.
Back at Tom Giesel's office, this time in his home, he's showing me one of his favorite pieces of equipment, a microfilm machine.
This is basically 35 millimeter film, a roll of it. It's newspapers that have been copied onto microfilm.
Giesel is also the National Farmers Union's historian, so he uses the machine to study the past. He's 64 years old, and sometimes he wonders whether he should retire early.
Well, I'm losing money. So that means if it goes 2 years this way, then I have to work another 4 or 5 years to get back where I'm at today. So why carry on?
Congress is going to be working on a farm bill next year, and farm advocates say this is not the time to cut funding. In Larned, Kansas, I'm Peggy Lowe for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it is this week's sign the apocalypse is surely upon us. Love Flutter, it's a dating app, I guess, has a new premium service, Love Flutter Blue, it's called. It matches people who have those little blue check marks by their names on Twitter. I know, right? Although, and I am straight up stealing this from this show's producer, Nancy Fargali, when she heard about this today. Really? Should have been called Checkmate. All right, we are going. The Dow up 100 points today, 0.4%, 21,613. NASDAQ up a point, 64.12. S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.2%, 24.77. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.